Hope your day went well this morning, getting ready. You know, in some places and some circumstances, I'm sure this never happened to my wife and I, but we get pretty rushed getting ready for services, especially when you were getting kids ready and trying to get them to cooperate, and they necessarily didn't want to cooperate. And sometimes you get into the car about half mad. And sometimes those arguments go on until you get to the church building. And then you kind of smooth it out for a while. And hopefully it'll be forgotten by the time you get back in the car. At least that's the hope of that. I've titled our class lesson this morning, "Have you ever had a day like this?" And just thought I'd see which one works. Not that one. But that one does. And this could be any day, and this list could be different, but have you ever had a day when the alarm didn't go off? I don't know if you use an alarm or not, but if you use an alarm, you depend upon an alarm. What if you set it wrong? Or what if you forgot to put it on when you set it and make it come? And what about a day when you're late and you can't find the car keys? You have this spot that you always put them, but they never end up there. And so you're looking all over the house trying to find the car keys and find out where you're going. You're looking at your watch at the same time, and it's become frustrating. Or how about that day you didn't realize you forgot your wallet? You pull in. Now, you can't hardly do this nowadays because they use cards, but you pull into the gas station, you pump full of gas, and you reach for your wallet, and you haven't got it. I have been to the grocery store, loaded up a basket, taken it up, reached for my wallet, and it wasn't there. And I didn't know that I'd forgotten it. Sometimes when I get back home, I don't know where it's at either. I have to go looking for it. And then, this is pretty common. How about the day you're in a hurry and you get behind a school bus? A school bus that's stopping about every 50 feet. Because the kids don't walk to where they go anymore, you know. You stop right in front of their house to pick them up. And so the day's just, it's just not going the way you wanted it to go. My wife doesn't like this one. You know, when I drive and the gas gauge gets down and that little icon, which we didn't used to have, matter of fact, twice I ran out of gas up here in downtown Sanford because back then I had a vehicle that if you parked it on a hill, all the gas flowed to the front, and the pickup must have been in the back of the tank because if you were like a quarter full and you parked like that, it wasn't going to start. You know, it was going to sit there. And boy, that is frustrating because you can't push it up out of a hill. So that little icon lights up and you're wondering, I might be 25 from the next nearest gas station, 25 miles, and so you know you're worried about whether you're going to run out, and I want you to say, when I use these illustrations, it's not because that's a habit, or is it? But I have rolled into the gas station with the engine off, you know, where I had run out of gas. I keep it pretty full now, but I used to like to run it, just it seemed right to me to run it down to empty before you filled it up. I won't do that anymore, you know. And, of course, that day you get to work and you never even think about it. You go to work, you work that half a day, lunchtime comes, and I forgot to bring lunch. And you might work at a job you don't get to leave and go get lunch, and so you're just out of luck, and you go sit with your coworkers, and you kind of look sad, you know, so they'll say, "Hey, you want a banana?" or something like that. And then, of course, today, in our time, you forgot your phone. We never even thought about carrying a phone. But now that we do carry them, it's like I can't leave. It's about as important as a wallet. You know, if you forget your wallet, you can call somebody and tell them you forgot it. Could they bring it to you? But you forget your phone, you can't even do that. There are in our lives a lot of frustrating days. And these are pretty lighthearted. At least they're pretty lighthearted except when they actually happen. And when they actually happen, they're frustrating to us. And so, I wonder if you've ever kind of asked yourself this question: what's next, Lord? You know, what else is going to go wrong today? And you're thinking that way, and sometimes, especially if you have several days, or even sometimes several weeks in a row, that just kind of seem to beat you all the time. And you're finally wondering, what has somebody got against me? And some people think it's the Lord that's got something against them when that sort of thing happens. So I want to talk about some people in the Bible, and I want you to consider their lives for a minute. And the purpose of this, I'll give you the punchline, you know, sort of at the end. But the purpose of this is to try to come to an understanding that things happen that make life irritating. Things happen that make life tough. But almost nothing happens to us like happened to these few people that we're going to look at. First of all, let's consider Joseph. You know the story of Joseph, Genesis 37, Genesis 38 and 39. He's a young man, the youngest of his family, at least at the point in time that that some of this occurred. And yet he was apparently very favored by his father. Jacob liked him. He's the one that gets the coat of many colors, specially made for him. And his brothers hate him. And I don't mean they hate him kinda. They have a vocal hatred of him. He has these two dreams, as you're reading 39 to the end of Genesis, he has these two dreams that show, in both of them, one with cows and one with wheat, that show that he's going to be ruling over them eventually. And they really hate him. So one day, his father sends him out. The other sons are out with the flocks, trying to see what's going on. And his father sends him out to just check on him and see what's happening and maybe take some things to them. And they see him coming. How much do you have to hate your brother to say, let's kill him? That's what they thought about doing. They were talked out of that. And so they put him in a pit. While Reuben was away, a passing caravan was coming. And they said, we got somebody for you. And they sell him into slavery to a passing caravan. I tell you, you talk about a self-image problem. That would give you a self-image problem about your family. So he gets down to Egypt. And he's sold to a man named Potiphar. God, though, is with him. That's a key issue. God is with him. And he's sold to this man named Potiphar. He rises. He keeps rising. His work and his integrity and the character that he has, he keeps rising and rising. Till finally, he's over everything that Potiphar has. Potiphar doesn't even look at the stuff he has because he trusts Joseph that much. But Potiphar's wife had designs on Joseph. And so she tried to seduce him. Wasn't able to. And I don't know, a woman scorned, she was. And she decided she was going to get even. So she lied about it and said that he had assaulted her. And Potiphar took her word for it, as you would if it was your wife, and had him put in prison. So first his brothers hate him. He sold into slavery. Then he's thrown into prison. And in prison, he meets, as you know, two of the servants of Pharaoh. They have dreams. He's able to interpret those dreams. And the first thing that's interesting to me is those two men are going to be taken back out of prison, by the way, one to be killed and one to be exalted. But those two men are going to be taken back. He says, remember me when you get before Pharaoh. But they didn't. Another bad day. Actually, another bad couple of years as he went on. And then finally, he was released from prison. He did become, as you well know, second to everybody second to Pharaoh and over everyone else that was in Egypt. But God's still with him. God's still working with him. And so he decides that he's going to deliver his people. By the way, we understand that he decided that he was going to deliver his people way before he did, because in Acts chapter 7, it was at the time that he kills the Egyptian who was beating one of his countrymen. It was at that time that he thought God would use him to deliver the people. He was wrong about the timing. God was going to use him, but he was wrong about the timing. And so now he has to flee Egypt. So now he's a fugitive from justice as well. All in all, it would almost seem, except for that stint with Pharaoh, it would almost seem that he had a pretty rough life about things. I know that he had a life that was way different than you and I losing our car keys, or you and I running out of gas, or you and I forgetting our wallet. The things that happened to him were serious things. We would count them extremely serious things, and properly so. The Apostle Paul, did I already do that? I did it too much. I must be pressing it while I set it down up here. I must be pressing it along the way. Let's think about Naomi for a minute. Naomi's a good Jewish woman. She's keeping the law. She's married. Things are going well. But then something strikes the whole area of Israel. Nothing wrong with that. And if you're reading this, in the book of Ruth, you realize that a famine struck. And so the first thing that happens, and some of you ladies, you can identify to this. Maybe some of you can't. Maybe it doesn't matter to some of you. But all of a sudden, her husband says, "We're moving. We're not, I mean, most of Israel's staying down there. We're not going to stay here. We're not going to suffer through this. We're going to move." And so they're going to move up to Moab. And so that's the first thing, is that she's uprooted after the famine hits. Don't know how long they stayed there after the famine hit. Maybe they stayed for a year. Maybe they stayed for a year and a half. But he decided to uproot them and move them. I never thought much about that. Moving never bothered me. And as a preacher, I moved on several occasions. And it just didn't impact me. But I found out a little bit late how much it impacted my children and my wife, for that matter. I don't know how much it impacted her to move. But so she moves to this strange land. Things go pretty good for a while. I mean, they live up there. Things are going all right. Her two sons marry two of the ladies from up there who decide that they're going to worship with the sons. But then the father dies, her husband, and then her children die. And all there is left is the two daughter-in-laws. And they're good daughter-in-laws, but they're not her people, are they? As a matter of fact, she decides in that process, after the grieving is done and so forth, she decides, "I'm going to go back to Israel because things have improved down there. The famine is not like it was down there." And so she decides, "I'm going to go back down there." And her daughter said, "Well, we're going to go with you." And she said, no. She said, "Go back to your father's houses." Each would have had different fathers. "Go back to your father's houses and, you know, you'll be able to find someone among your own people that you can marry." And that's when Ruth said, "No, I'm going to go with you, and your people will be my people, and your God will be my God." And I'm satisfied she already knew quite a bit about Jehovah because of that circumstance. So then she goes back down, and by the way, I know I'm not reading all these verses, because I'm just telling the story to make a point at the end, but you can write down the verses and certainly welcome to go and read them. She goes back down, and she comes, and she bewails her condition. She said, I went away full, God brought me back empty. I went away joyful, God brought me back in bitterness. So she's going back. She doesn't have anyone. She's got some kinsmen, but not immediate family back there, because they died. She buried them in another land. And now, she doesn't have a harvest to take in. She doesn't have a job. Women that day didn't have jobs the way we do. They went out and they planted and they worked the fields and so forth. And this was too soon. She didn't have anything for that. So she tells Ruth to go out. And Ruth goes out. And you know the story that she ends up at Boaz's field. And Boaz takes favor on her. Partly at least because it was the kind of man Boaz was. He was a good man, and she was a diligent worker, and he had heard how well she had treated her mother-in-law, Naomi. And so he was impressed by that. So he treats her well, has a little extra. You remember how in the Old Testament times, among the Jews, this was not true, by the way, among most people, but among the Jews, God provided for the poor by telling them that as you're out harvesting the wheat and some of it falls by the wayside, don't pick it up. You leave it set there. And when you get to the corners, leave a big section of the corner. That was in order that the poor might come and be able to harvest something and have something to eat. And that's what Ruth was doing, because she was a hard worker. And so things begin to look up for Naomi, just as, by the way, they did look up for Moses. Now, I could go into a lot more about Moses as we talked about it, but we won't do that. I want us to look at another. Let's think about Job. Time-wise, Job's misery was not that long. I don't know how long it took for all the things that we read about in Job. I'm going to talk about them here in a minute. I don't know how long it took for those things to happen. Did it happen over a year, or did it happen over 2 years? I would say not much more, over 2 or 3 years at the most. Satan has this conversation with God, and I got to be honest with you. I don't understand that whole circumstance. I don't get what the situation was there, but I know that Satan has this conversation with God, challenges him about Job, because God said, "Have you considered my Job? Here's an upright man, one that fears God and eschews evil." Well, Satan said, "Well, yeah, of course he does. Look how rich you've made him. Look how you protected him. Look at the reputation you've given him. Look at the way he lifted up. In other words, his life is perfect. Why wouldn't he be faithful to you?" And God says, do what you want to him. Only don't harm him himself. Had Job known what Satan was going to get done, he would have said, take me, Lord. I'm the one that needs to be chastised. Because on the same day, one after another, servants come in who have just barely escaped with their life and tell him that all of his flocks have been taken. That's all of his living. They come in and they tell him that houses have fallen. They come in especially and they tell him all of his children have been killed. What a day. And by the way, I know how people normally think of a day like that, because that's the way Job's wife felt. Don't you remember? She said, curse God and die. I mean, he's going to do this too. He's going to let this happen. Just get it over with. Curse God and die. And Job never did. He never thought that God had abandoned him. But he did not understand what went wrong. So now, in this final challenge that Satan makes to God, he says, go ahead, strike his flesh, but don't take his life. Have you ever been miserable enough to take a piece of glass and scrape the sores that you have on your body and that bring relief? That's what Job did. He took broken pieces of pottery and scraped where he had sores on his body. I just can't imagine what that was. But in the meantime, in this whole process, you see, the attitude in that day was that, well, by the way, what time is class over? Okay, thank you. I can see the clock. Y'all can't, but I can. Job had lost respect. He was considered one of the wise ones in his community, maybe the wisest. He certainly was one of, if not the wealthiest. And he did so much good with everything that he had. I mean, it wasn't like he just kept it and he was mean. People liked him. You know, he's going to make the statement, you know, I was feet to the lame and I was eyes to the blind. And then he even says, after all, he says, the cause that I knew not. In other words, there are people out there that had needs that I didn't know about. He said, I went out and looked for them so that I could help them. That's the kind of man that Job was. And so when his wife had that attitude of curse God and die, Job says, no, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. But he did want to know, why is this happening to me? That's kind of that frustration I was talking about a little bit earlier. And our frustrations are nothing like this. And we look, everything's gone wrong today, or everything's gone wrong this week, or maybe everything went wrong this year, because sometimes people have a long series of troubles. And we wonder, why? Why is this happening to me? Why does the Lord allow this? It's not whether the Lord always makes it happen, but why does the Lord allow this to happen to me? I don't know if you've ever had any of those frustrating days or any of those moments, but some people have, and they have, to be honest, many of them have quit the Lord, blamed the Lord, and just decided not to be faithful anymore. I could name right now on my hand at least four people that I know of who have done that. Good people. But for some reason, in some way, they blame the Lord for what happened. Let's consider Paul. And maybe we know more about Paul. We've studied more about Paul. We think more about Paul than anybody. But if you haven't read Paul's own description of the troubles he had in 2 Corinthians 11, you ought to take the time to do that. Because Paul didn't have a bad day. He had a bad life. And he knew that was coming, by the way. When he was on the road to Damascus, and he saw the light that shone round about him, and he went on into Damascus, and he was in the city, and God appeared to Ananias, and he said, I need you to go over there and talk to Saul. It wasn't Paul then. And talk to Saul. And Ananias said, Lord, he's come to persecute Christians. And God says, no, he's a chosen vessel for me. I'm going to send him to the Gentiles. And he said, but I must, here's the way he introduced Paul to his work. I must show him all of the things that he must suffer. Can you imagine putting this, and you've heard this illustration before, but can you imagine you've got this job of preaching is going to be done. So you put an ad in the paper and say, now, you will be rejected by most of the people you know. You're going to be beaten by in some of the cities and places that we send you. You're going to spend time in prison. You might even be stoned. Chances are you're going to have a few wrecks along the way that are life-threatening. You're going to be in danger of robbers, and it's going to be a bad life. That's what he told Saul. I need to show him all the things he's going to suffer. And yet Saul, knowing that, chose to serve the Lord. And we'll look at a few of the things that he says in regard to that. And he learned a lesson. He learned a lesson there in 2 Corinthians 12, and we're going to come back to that and talk about that as we come to the as we come to the conclusion of what we're looking at. Now here's the right question to ask. I said it earlier. I want you to think about this. You're frustrated. Everything's gone wrong. Maybe some serious things. Maybe some death. Maybe cancer. Maybe something else. And I mean, it's serious. And you're sitting there and you're wondering, why? Why is this happening to me? And you say, you know, it's like, what's next, Lord? That's the right question. But it's the wrong inflection. The right inflection is, okay, Lord, you got me through that. What's next? What else do I get to use my faith in? What else do I get to get stronger in? Some of you have been athletes in times past. You have exercised. And you know, you never grow in exercise without going to the point that it hurts. That's just a fact. You can kind of stay the same if you want to level off and do that. But if you want to advance, you got to put more weights on that barbell, and it literally can hurt to lift them. You've got to run that extra mile or extra 2 miles, and literally your legs start aching, your back starts hurting, your your lungs certainly are hurting. And God wants you to use those as a victory. He wants you to see that difficulty that you're having as an exercise that raises you to a higher level. You know, going back to the time of Joseph, you know, Joseph tells his brothers, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. God had a plan." You're familiar with Romans 8:28. We know that all things work together. And you got to stop and you got to think about that. We know that all things work together for good. Not the good things, not the happy things. We know that all things work together for good to them that love God and to them who are the called according to His purpose. I mean, that's an amazing statement. God is saying that these things that are out here that happen to you, that are difficult, that are hard, that are hurtful, that's going to set the stage for me to do good. You might not even see the good. As a matter of fact, you might not even benefit from the good. You remember when God walked Abraham through the land of Canaan and he said, "I'm giving this to you." Well, no. I'm not giving it to you, but I am giving it to your descendants. They're going to get it 400 years from now. Abraham, by his actions and by his faith and by the things that he went through, he set the stage for God to be able to bring the children of Israel into the land of Canaan. And that's what God means in Romans 8:28 when he's talking about that. In Matthew 25... That's the picture, by the way, of the, well, we have a couple pictures in there, but that's the pictures where the talents are given out and where also God separates the sheep from the goats. He gives us that peak. We don't have many of those. Matthew 7, we have one. Matthew 25, we have one. But he gives us a peak into what the judgment will be like. And, you know, he's got all nations gathered before them, and he's going to separate them as shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. By that way, that's a real thing. If you get to watch much about shepherding, that they do take the sheep a different place to graze than they take the goats because they graze differently. So you separate the sheep from the goats. And that's what he's talking about here. And he talked to people who had, you know, I was sick, I was hungry, I was naked, I was thirsty, I was in prison. You didn't minister to me. And they said, when do we see you like that? And then he tells those that are saved, I was sick, hungry, in prison, naked, and you ministered to me. And they said, when do we see you like that? And of course, his answer was, inasmuch as you did it unto one of the least of these my brethren, you did it to me. Inasmuch as you did it not unto one of the least of these my brethren, you did it not unto me. And so through life, these people had difficulties that they could respond to, that they had the opportunity to respond to. It was a way for God to be able to do what he needed to do. Hebrews chapter 12. As a matter of fact, the book of Hebrews. Let's just think about the book of Hebrews for a minute. You've been told, and I'm sure you remember, that somebody says, well, the book of Hebrews is about a better covenant. And he starts with chapter 1, and he goes through chapter 9, actually part of chapter 10 as well. He goes through chapter 10, and he talks about all the ways that the new covenant is better than the old covenant. If it stopped there, we would have, except for the general idea that the new covenant is better, we'd have no understanding of why he wrote the book of Hebrews. We finally find out why he wrote the book of Hebrews as you continue on there, in chapters 9 and 10. And you know, they're told there in chapter 10, 23, that you know, that we should hold fast the profession of our faith, and that we should consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works. What was happening was that many of them were leaving the Lord because they were suffering persecution. Then we get down into chapter, and you're familiar with verse 25 of chapter 10, forsake not the assembling yourselves together as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another so much the more as you see the day approaching. For if we sin willfully, after that we received a knowledge of the truth, there remains no more sacrifice for sin, but a certain fearful looking for of judgment and fiery indignation, which shall devour the adversary. Man that despised Moses' law, he died without mercy under two or three witnesses. How much sore punishment do you think he shall be counted worthy, who hath trodden underfoot the Son of God, counted the blood of the covenant wherewith he was sanctified, an own holy thing, and done despite unto the Spirit of grace? And then he says, he gets down to verse 30 and 31, and he says, I want you to consider the way you acted when you first became Christians. And you joyfully took the spoiling of your goods. What's next, Lord? Well, joyfully, what's next was the opportunity to be even stronger the next time around. You joyfully took the spoiling of your goods, and they even, when other people suffered, not when they were suffering, but when other people of the same faith, the Lord's faith, were suffering, they became companions of them that were so used. And then he goes into the explanation finally about it in chapter 12. Chapter 11, he talks about all those men and women of faith. And he gets into chapter 12, and he finally says, you need to remember that the Lord chastens every son whom he receives. He's talking about the troubles that they're having. He's talking about the persecutions that they're having. And he's saying, that's the Lord chastening you, because we need that kind of chastening. We need that kind of difficulty in our life. So I want you to turn your Bible to two passages as we get ready to close out our lesson this morning. And by the way, I didn't even consider whether we normally have participation in this class. I just talked. You probably do normally have participation. But turn to James 1 with me. Because this is about what's next, Lord. That's what this section of Scripture is about. We're going to read verse 2 and verse 3 and verse 4. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, various difficulties, depending on the translation that you might be reading. Knowing that the testing, what's the testing? That's when you fall into difficulties. That's when all these things that we talked about, when you say, well, what's next, Lord? And also some things that we bring on ourselves by our own sin, and we bear the consequences of that. And it's like, you know, what can I do about this? knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. Let patience have its perfect work. I like the word complete there because it has a more of the idea of what's needed. That you may be perfect, complete, lacking nothing. In other words, God says, what you need to say when you've gone through a particularly good time, you need to look at the Lord and say, thank you, Lord. And Lord, what's next? I'm ready for it. Not, what's next, Lord? What could happen that's worse? But I'm ready for it. I'm ready. I'm ready to move on to the next step. I don't know if you remember or not, and I'm not sure that it has a specific application, but in the qualifications of the deacons, in Titus 3, in 1 Timothy 3, when it's talking about in verse 8, the deacon that used the office well purchased to themselves a good degree and great boldness in the faith. Well, the good degree, literally that means the next step. The next step up. In other words, they've gone through the service that God wants them to do. They've put up with the difficulties of God, and they step up. Well, that's what he's talking about here. That's what he's talking about. You poor? That's good. That's good. God can use that. You have a sickness? How about the woman that had the issue of blood all of her life? That's good. That's good because God can use that. You having to sit with a spouse that has cancer, that's good. And I don't mean the things that are happening are good. I mean that God is able to work together for good. God is able to do something with you because of that. That's what James is saying. When you have those trials, that's good. Because it's a chance to build your spiritual muscles. And if God's given you a chance to build your spiritual muscles, it's because you're going to need them. It's because there's going to be other circumstances where you need to do that. I'm in just a few days, I'll be 76. And I've known this idea for a little while, but I hadn't done anything about it, you know. It's just an idea that I knew about. I knew that when I passed that age of 50, that my muscles were going to begin to atrophy, or atrophy, however you want to say it. And I knew that I was going to get weaker. And I watch people, and I realize what they're doing, and I never understood why they move so slow, you know? I never understood why getting up out of a bench was something where they could do it, but they had to put their hands on something and kind of pull themselves up. I understand that now. I understand it's because when we're young, we're constantly doing so many things that exercise our muscles, keeps our core strength, and so forth, that we are overdoing, we are over-exercising, like the weightlifter that lifts more weights than he's ever going to have to lift, but he does that, and so he gets stronger. If in the spiritual matters, we don't exercise our spiritual muscles, we get weaker. You get weaker and you don't even know you're getting weaker. I've gotten weaker. I know it now. But when I passed 50, I thought, well, I'm good. I got up there to 60 and I'm good. And then at 60, I stopped doing much. For a couple of reasons. Had an injury to my knees and so forth. But I stopped doing much and it was like, okay. I'm okay. And then I started putting on a pound or two. I'm okay. I can take it off whenever I want. What I'm saying is, we've got to have these difficulties. We've got to have these challenges. We need that. Turn back to Romans 5 with me. Because I only got a couple minutes, I think, left here. I want you to see this twice. You saw it in James. James is saying it's a good thing to have these difficulties. Not that the difficulties are good, but it's a good thing to have them because of the way it can strengthen you. Look now, chapter 5, verse 1. Therefore, having been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have access by faith into this grace wherein we stand and rejoice in hope of the glory of God. Now listen to verse 3. Not only that, we also glory in tribulations. Like Paul said, you know, and when he concluded in 2 Corinthians 12:9, he said, I glory in my infirmities because the Lord can be with me and help me be something with that. Knowing that tribulation produces perseverance, and perseverance character, and character hope. That's what drives us to be faithful to God and to have a hope of heaven. If you and I take the easy way in anything about Christianity, if we take the easy way in evangelism, the easy way in evangelism is if somebody comes and says, I'd like to have a study, you say yes, but you're not going out to them and saying, would you like to have a study? Because that's the harder way. The easy way is putting the fork down. I mean, eating what's in front of me, rather. The hard way is putting the fork down and not eating that. If we always take the easy way in spiritual matters, you will be a weak Christian. It's because you take the hard way. You do the things that are work. By the way, God called, I must work the works of him that sent me. While it is yet day, it was work. It never was the easy way. It wasn't the easy way for Christ. It's not the easy way for us. So when you're thinking, what's next, Lord, because the day is so frustrating, what you need to be saying, that's good, Lord, I got through that. What's next? You've helped me through that. I know you'll help me through the next one. What's next? And take the hard way. I mean, take the way that you're constantly putting yourself in the path of work, in the path of difficulty. The easy way for the Apostle Paul, when he saw all the people there in Athens and all the idolaters, he said, well, I can't teach the gospel to these people. They're idolaters. And go on his way. The hard way was to stand up and say, you've got somebody you don't understand how to worship. And none of these gods are the real thing. Jesus talked about the prophets. And he was looking in Matthew 23:23, he said, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that stonest the prophets and kills those that are sent unto you. How often I would have gathered you, your children, as a hen gathers her chickens under her wings, but you would not. Therefore your house is left to you desolate. Now, I want you to boil that down to one. Our house, our spiritual house, my spiritual house, is desolate if I don't take the hard way, the way of obeying everything that God would have us to do, the way of being thankful for the difficulties that are in my life. You know, we're all born into different circumstances. Some people are born into rich families. Some people are born into poverty-stricken families. Some people are born with cancer. You've been probably seen some of that on the internet because there are lots of babies that are talked about. And certainly there are advertisements on television about kids that are that. And it's like, how am I going to get through that? Some people are born with disformities. We're all born differently. But we all have the chance to say, Lord, thank you for what I have. Thank you for what I am. And let me use it to get stronger. Don't get frustrated at God and don't get frustrated at people. Be frustrated yourself if you're not falling on God. Like Paul, I wanted this thorn in the flesh to be taken away. And then he says, now I glory in tribulation. When I have those difficulties, I know it makes me stronger. Thank you for your attention.